Welcome to Season 3 of Meet Me at the Chazen. I'm your host, Jennifer Fields. In this season, we'll cover a question closer to our hearts than we might realize or even want to admit. What to do with the things we need or want to keep, but don't necessarily use in our daily lives? Lindsay Grinstead is the Chief of Staff for the Chazen. She knows what I'm talking about.
You probably have a box of stuff in some dusty, crusty closet somewhere, like we all do, right? And the museum does too, except we had like 50, 70, I don't know, 100 boxes or more in the basement.
Our focus this season is on the Chazen Archive. It's huge. Not to worry, we won't be in this alone. Jordan Craig is the archivist.
I don't usually think of an archive as a noun. It's more like archive as a verb. It's like, what does it mean to archive something, rather than like, what is the archive? Because I feel like people generally have some sense of like what an archive is, but don't necessarily know what it means to archive something.
Rachel Johnson is the project manager.
An archive is my happy place. I think it's like a living dictionary or thesaurus, maybe even an encyclopedia. I think it could be all three of those things. Something that is constantly growing and gaining information with almost a limitless point of view, I guess.
Making decades of information accessible can be daunting and costly. So how does a major university museum find the time and the money to tackle this task? According to Lindsay Grinstead, by applying for funding.
So the Mellon Grant is really cool because it helped us solve an issue that the museum had and the university had together, which was digital preservation and archiving. So you probably have a box of stuff in some dusty, crusty closet somewhere, like we all do, right? And the museum does too, except we had like 50, 70, I don't know, 100 boxes or more in the basement. We also had dusty, crusty things on files, digital files that were old formats that may not survive in the future as technology evolves, things like that. And the university through UW Libraries had already been building infrastructure to solve this problem for their data and finding ways to preserve it and building the background structure. What that includes, I have no idea, because it's a lot of programming and tech and really complicated stuff. So we didn't know either. But I think through conversations with Amy, our director, and Lisa Carter, who was the head of the libraries at that time, realized that we have some commonalities, that we have these things living in different places, and how can we sort of bring them to light, bring them literally out of the basement, out of their boxes, and make them accessible to more people and make sure that they last for a lifetime or more, knowing what we know today about technology.
I feel like I'm coming to the museum world from a different pathway. And so in my head, I just imagine like some, I don't know, a room that you could also mistake for a surgery arena. Everything clean and white and pristine, and you have to have special clothes and gloves and a hood on to go down there and see this stuff.
Yeah, so it was kind of a mix of things, and it reflects sort of what does the organization value the most, right? And all art museums are going to tell you that their doc files, the files that they have on every artwork that they have acquired, are pristinely kept. And we have a whole special room for them here and a whole filing system and all of that. And we also have our entire collection available digitally online, which is a great feat for an art museum in it of itself, but it's only a piece of the puzzle. So the other files that I'm talking about were archival documents about the building and the museum and how that came to be, and the exhibition files. So exhibition files typically don't live with the object. So say we had a Picasso exhibition in 1976 that we brought here, and it had a bunch of other loans, and it had our Picasso piece in it too. You may not find that information in the artwork file. That was in a box downstairs. But that information is actually really useful to people researching Picasso or, you know, working on a dissertation, looking for a book and things like that. And it's information that's typically not available for museums. You can learn a lot about their collection and their artwork, but the sort of history of the institution and how those artworks have been used through exhibitions and different installations and things over the years is not as widely accessible, because that's not what we're using day to day in the office. Or, you know, we're not valuing it as much and we're sticking it downstairs.
What did the Mellon Grant allow this particular institution, the Chazen, to do with all that sort of, all that information?
Yeah, so I think it really did two things. It allowed us to, like I said, bring all of these things to light and give access. But how did it do that? Mellon funded the infrastructure for us to build the technology side of it to make a process for archiving, so that in the future, when we acquire new objects and have exhibitions, there is a clear procedure for how we archive all of that material and make sure that it's preserved for the future in perpetuity. Right. So Mellon set that up by funding positions of programmers that built the technology over within their working primarily in the libraries. It funded Jordan's position, who's really sort of worked on the museum side of things and providing all of the data and information and processing all of the archives. So when I thought of it first, you know, I thought, well, can we just scan everything and like put it in a file? You know, that's like my idea of archiving.
Right.
But it's not that simple, because actually the files that we have today, just like you probably remember using a floppy disk, can become obsolete in the future. So the libraries had the expertise to tell us, these files aren't good in perpetuity, they're not preserved correctly, we have an idea of how to do it, and Mellon helped us fund that. And I also should mention that part of the Mellon grant was that the university would match a portion of it, a significant portion. So we also had to get the university behind this idea, which thankfully they did, because part of the justification is that it wasn't just for the Chazen's collection, that once we have this process and infrastructure in terms of technology, that it can be a blueprint for other collections on campus and even other universities to do the same. There are lots of other collections on campus that deal with the same thing, that have their data and parts of their collection in all different formats and places. And so the idea was that, you know, by being the pilot for this, that we could create something that could be duplicated and makes the whole university more accessible, which is really, you know, it sounds cheesy, but it is in line with the Wisconsin idea. The idea that education should, and the things that happen here at the University of Wisconsin are accessible beyond just the classroom. And the awesome thing about this project now is, you know, when you go and search on UW Libraries' main catalog site, if you're searching for something like the Picasso example, you're going to get all their books and information that they have, but you may also get the link for the piece in our collection, which includes, you know, the background information on any exhibitions that we've had about Picasso or any times it's been mentioned in other publications. And that just like explodes our access, because now we're not counting on people coming to our site to go through our collection search. Anyone in the world now can go through UW's site and have access to all these things that, you know, weren't being seen before.
As I learned more about the archive, it makes me think of information that I want to share. When we think about garage sales and we think about house sales and we think about, what do you call those? Estate sales. When we think about estate sales, part of what makes them exciting is understanding, well, I prefer an estate sale to going to a thrift store, because I can see the full picture of the individual when I'm in their house picking up these things. And so then I think about things that we may have as individuals that we may want to leave for someone else. How much information, you know, knowing this now makes me think about how much information I want to include with that object as I leave it for the next person.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think we've talked about this before, but like, I have, my house is 124 years old. I have like an antique engagement ring. And those are the two things that if I could ask for like any genie in the bottle question of, could I see a history of these things? I would love to see who wore this ring for the last 100 years. What did my house look like 50, 60 years ago? All of that information has just vanished because, you know, there wasn't a system for setting up, you know, people didn't take the time to archive and preserve that information, or maybe they did and it was lost because it was in a format that, you know, didn't survive. So it's really exciting that, you know, that's the type of thing that we're trying to do here, is make sure that that information is accessible and lives on. I don't know what Jordan would say about this, but I kind of think about it like Ancestry.com too. You know, you're all of a sudden you're putting all this out there and we don't know who's going to find value or information from it, but
you're putting all the dots out there and telling other people, okay, now you can connect them if you want. Like if you find something you see here that helps your research or, you know, helps an acquisition that you're trying to make at another museum, we're just trying to, you know, increase the availability of that information and then see what connections people draw from it. That's my understanding of it as someone who, you know, was involved in the process. Just that's part of, you know, my job as chief of staff is kind of knowing a little bit of everything that's going on, and I might not be the primary person writing the grant or executing all of the activities that come out of it, but sort of, you know, sitting in and making sure that then I can sort of bridge the gaps across the museum to help the project come to life. And so from my perspective, that's what the Mellon Grant feels like in the way that it's been explained to me and the way that I sort of understand it now. But I think it will be really cool for you to actually go through the process, because I'm interested too to see how it looks and feels and sounds from start to finish.
Jordan Craig is digital asset coordinator, multimedia archivist, and self-professed nerd for this season. So one of the things about the archive that I've been wrestling with since this project appeared is I kind of have, I think, a very limited idea of what an archive is and how an archive is used. So I'm going to ask you as much as you can in layman's terms, in Jennifer speak, what is an archive? What is this thing that we're standing in, this place that we're standing in right now?
Actually, can I get it in Jennifer speak first? Like, what do you think?
To me, an archive is where you keep things that for whatever reason are no longer used in a daily way, but you may need access to them. In my house, my archive would be all the old cords and power packs and headphones, because I never know when something's going to break and I may need to use something else to make it last. For example, if you notice, my shoelaces are different. This morning, I broke my right shoelace and I had to rip apart a cat toy to create a shoelace for my shoe. So that's kind of like my way of thinking about an archive or anything that I would have in my house or anything that would maybe serve that purpose. Could this go back in it? I don't know. Could this become a cat toy again? I don't know. I kind of like the thicker shoelace, so maybe not. But it's that idea of you have something that has some value, even though it may not have currency in the now.
Yeah, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head.
Our work here is done.
like essentially what we're in now is like a repository of the museum's inactive records. So there's sort of like a misconception that like the archive is just like old stuff, you know, but it's really just inactive, and those aren't the same thing. I think maybe like the thing that's hard for me, it's like, I don't usually think of an archive as a noun. It's more like archive as a verb. It's like, what does it mean to archive something, rather than like, what is the archive? Because I feel like people generally have some sense of like what an archive is, but don't necessarily know what it means to archive something. Like, remember that like chat we were having with Adam about how like there's stuff in the editorial, or like there's random editorial stuff in a closet upstairs, and it's like, yeah, that's the quote, air quotes, archive materials, but like really it's just they're stored there, because like in my head they didn't go through an archival process like to make them discoverable and to preserve them.
Where do you begin? Do you just grab a box and start going? Is there an architecture to it? Because I'm imagining the first step of that coming into a project new is discovery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the first step when I got here was kind of broad inventory. And I think maybe what separates like my work from the work of the people upstairs, like the museum people, it's I'm used to working with like information in aggregate as opposed to like object level stuff. So like let's actually head over out here. When I first got here, this room was basically empty. Andrea had like high school students kind of rotating and like creating like a file level inventory like before I got here. So when I came, it was just the student, a box, and that table, basically. Like, that's kind of all we had in here. So, Like, people walk in here now and be like, oh, it's a lot nicer than I thought. It's like, oh, yeah, you think I'm living in, like, a dungeon down here? Like, no.
Because, you know, it's funny that all these things have so much meaning and so much value. And the value is from the beginning to the end, but it just has these stages where it's kind of an unknown. Like, at some point, you know, I think about people actively working on things. Like, we've looked a lot at, what's that clanking?
Who knows?
Wow, that's interesting. It does, listen.
It never goes away, though.
If you people don't, if this is the last you hear from me, Jordan is your first suspect. Anyway. Because we're in the basement, like we're surrounded by cement. We're in something that's very secure, but it also, there's a daunting aspect to it. It's like, it does feel like I'm in somewhere where I do have to have a special key and clearance and passage. But then this stuff is kind of in limbo until you turn your attention to it. Is that fair to say? Like, this is all important. Well,
what do you mean limbo?
It's kind of just sitting here. It's yeah. Waiting. It's waiting to be reacted. It's waiting. It's a noun now. It's a noun. Now, and it's waiting to become your verb.
Yes. I don't think I can put it any better myself.
Well, you started that, so hey.
Okay, so, oh right, we came out here. Going like, okay, how did we start with this stuff?
It's like opening up presents. Because you don't know what's in these boxes necessarily until you start digging through them.
Not necessarily, unless they're labeled well. Which was actually a huge thing when I first started, was looking at the labels of all the boxes. Sometimes they were completely unhelpful, like it said, black file cabinet. It's just like, why would anyone care if it was in a black file cabinet? Like, actually, but that's a metadata thing. It's like, let's make metadata useful.
So, okay, now you know I have a thing about metadata. Every time you say it, I think you want my social security number.
No.
So define metadata for me so I can calm down, because I can feel my head starting to tighten up.
Right. So metadata is essentially providing context for information. So like what I have here on these boxes, okay, it's like this label says Chazen Museum of Art Exhibition Records. This is box 4 of the exhibition records. It holds this range of folders, 138.1 to 172.2. It goes from 1982, August 25th to 1984, October 13th. From the 138th exhibition to the 172nd, and it just gives like some brief titles like Edvard Munch in Costumes of Five Continents. But you should be able to get from like the finding aid, even without a finding aid, you can have a good sense of what's in this box from the label, as opposed to black file cabinet, you know?
So then I'm imagining that one thing we can think about is that when we see things in boxes and we see things on these shelves, we know that this is the proper area for them. Are there things that have to be stored in a way where they have to be more protected? These boxes are protected. This is a dry room. It's definitely a secure room. You need a key to get in here and permission. But are there things that you have to consider maybe getting to first, because they have to be stored in a way that protects them? And I can't think of what that could be, because in my head, anything could be in this archive.
Actually, one of the first things I did when I got here was go through the film. Because, like, after looking, kind of doing a cursory glance of, like, all the stuff we have, like, from a preservation standpoint, that was the most in danger. And still is. So digitizing our, like, U-matic tapes from like the 1970s was priority number one, and VHS tapes also. I don't know if I still have VHS parts in here, but I might. No, I might have recycled them all. Basically, there's some estimate of how long like all the VHS tapes have left, like in the world. It's like 10 or 20 years if you don't get them. Off of VHS, they're gonna be gone. Like, so.
Wow. Even the archive does tell a story of like object preservation and like digital history. When VHS came out, we thought that was the end all and be all. Then CDs and mini disc and floppy disc came out. That's like, oh my God.
And I have all those things out here.
And I would imagine you have to have all those things, because mm-hmm. you have to be able to access all these these objects in the way that they were used during that time period. So that I can imagine that you have like an array of, now listen, that does not mean y'all get to bring your deep VHS tapes here to Jordan and have her doing all that stuff, unless it's really cool and we really want to see them.
We've actually done that.
Wait, what?
Yeah, I had someone send me some VHS tapes from New York City, and I digitized them for her. Because they were related to this museum. Like, that's sort of the... basically, like, one of the determining factors of, like, how I decide, like, what film stays and what film we just, like, toss and get rid of. It's like, did it happen here at this museum? Like, if it happened here, we want to know about it, you know?
I think that because this is a museum that sits on a campus, it's a campus-based museum, then I think we're going to be, or I hope I'm going to be, pleasantly surprised to see where this, where these documents can take us.
Not 100% sure how to respond to that, because when you say things like that, my mind goes in a million places.
Where does it go?
Right now, I'm thinking about, like, the tour records behind us, and, like, how the museum gave tours to different departments on campus. Like, we have the med school tours in there, and, like, how docents would take med students around to, like, study anatomy and stuff. It's just, like, unexpected ways that this university is, like, interacting with this museum that I think is cool.
Rachel Johnson is a graduate student studying art history and library science. She is a UW Archives processing assistant and, thankfully, project manager for this season.
An archive is my happy place. I think it's like a living dictionary or thesaurus, maybe even an encyclopedia. I think it could be all three of those things, something that is constantly growing and gaining information with almost a limitless point of view, I guess.
How is it your happy place? Talk to me about Rachel and how an archive, the something that we think of, I think Lindsay said, like, dusty, fusty things we all have stored somewhere. How does an archive bring you? Because when I asked you that, your face just lit up, and I'm trying to figure out where that spark came from.
Well, it's my happy place because I'm nosy. It's just such a wonderful place full of different sorts of information, and you never know what you're going to find. It's almost like a hidden door exercise. When I'm handed a collection to process, sometimes I find something super cool that I've never seen before, or sometimes I find papers that are literally covered in bird poop. So it's always something new, despite it being maybe a repetitive process.
And so then when you're finding these new things, what immediately starts to happen for you? Is there some sort of language or an outline that starts to form in your head as you find an object or something that excites you in that way?
It depends on what I find. So if I find something that pertains to my thesis research or my art historical research, immediately I'm writing down where it is, what it is, that sort of thing. But if I find, say, like a recipe for a 20th century biscuit, like I love to cook. So to me, immediately I'm going to go make a copy of that recipe so that I can try it later. So I think it depends on what I find and what area of interest that is for me. But either way, it leads me down a rabbit hole.
So then, how do you, if it's something that you love so much, you talked about how if it pertains to you personally, what happens if it's something that is part of the university or part of your work life?
If it's something that's part of my work life, it depends on what it is. If it's something that is directly related to university history, but still is interesting to me, like I work a lot with processing some of the collections of the studio art teachers from years past. So in my work as an art historian, that is interesting, but it also benefits the university because I can then aid in developing a course about, for example, American art from the UW perspective.
So then when you're thinking about the archive, you're looking for things, you, like Jordan calls the archive a verb and not a noun. So when you're looking for things in the archive, or you, when you find an object, you're looking at not only the historical value and recording of it, but also how it can be put sometimes or maybe always into immediate use?
Yeah, actually, that is kind of the foundation of my research as an art historian. One of the things that I am passionate about is using archival resources to put them in the art history context. A lot of times when you talk to art historians, we all start from a painting. I like to say I start backwards. So I would start from a notebook or a sheet of paper left behind by somebody and trace that to the painting it corresponds to. But if it doesn't correspond to a painting, that doesn't make it any less art history, because it is still the history of art.
What sparks that search for you? What makes you want to know more about something?
Sometimes it's a photograph or a quote, or even if I just read that someone left a notebook or a budget behind. Like I said, I'm just nosy. It depends on the context, I guess, maybe of what I come across. Like if I'm Googling something and then I find something interesting in the Google, then I'm like, okay, what archival resources have been left behind that relate to this? So I think a lot of that probably just comes from the library science background as well, always looking for the historical resources, who left what behind and who has something to say about it.
When I started this project and they said that I could bring a student on, I immediately thought of you because of the conversations that we've had in the office. And I always, and this is going to sound horrible, and I don't mean it to sound horrible, but I always say Rachel would be awesome for this because she has a murder brain. But you, the watching you get excited, and I think it was an artist and a model, watching you get excited about something that happened hundreds of years ago, it's just delightful. It was such a pleasant way to live vicariously, because I was just starting this. I hadn't worked in this building for 2 seconds, it seemed, and you were popping up and talking about murder. And so I know you said you're nosy, and the reason why I do this is because I've always been called a busybody and a tattletale. That's kind of why this is perfect for me. But talk to me about that. How do you, with the excitement and the joy that it brings you, how do you separate your excitement and joy? How do you not influence the story by your own, by your, what you perceive or what you believe to be or what you hope this information leads you to?
That's actually a really good question, and it relates to the story that about that murder. Because it's largely, it's a solved case, but there are so many questions. And so I love to answer questions, and I've not found anything that really answers all of my questions. But in doing this exercise of research, I have learned to kind of separate myself. So the facts are the facts, and what I think happened 100 years later is only relevant if I'm going to use the factual information to then create a fictional story. So like if I was to, and I probably will maybe one day, use my research to create a fictional series, then that is where I can come in. In terms of my actual like thesis project and stuff, it is interesting to figure out how to leave yourself out of that. But I find that my manifestation of myself in that research is the quantity of items that I have to wade through in order to produce something. Because like you said, I get so excited. I'm just searching and searching and searching, and I find so many articles, and article from this newspaper, article from that newspaper, they say the same thing, but they're different. So I'm just like a collector of all of this stuff that now I have to go through and pick out the narrative that I want for my thesis or whatever it is that I'm doing.
So then when did you stop looking?
I personally don't. Because of the nature of what I study and the lack of resources, I am actively looking for these resources. I want to know where they are so that way I can use them and make them known to others. I mean, working at an archive, I understand the processing speed is only as fast as the person processing. And if you only have one person processing, you can have a huge backlog of really interesting stuff that nobody will get to. So I don't ever, which is why I also carry around flash drives. Like, I'm always searching. I have flash drives in my backpack. I've got a cloud drive on this device. So I'm just saving stuff everywhere.
And you're using the archival method of saving stuff everywhere so that you can access it and then perhaps share that with others in the future.
Yeah. One thing that I've found through all of my research is that there are sources available. Like, I think it's in Colorado. They have this awesome database of ancient newspapers that I never knew about until I was trying to find a person from the 20th century. So she actually transplanted from New York to Colorado, is in the Colorado newspapers. So stuff like that is important to me to save, and to save them in a way that I know, okay, this is from Colorado, so I can go back to that source, but also be a source for anybody else who is just curious about anything that happened in Colorado in 1925.
I'm slowly, not slowly realizing, I knew what I was doing from the outset, but this podcast is in a sense an archive. So then, are there tips you can give me on what I should be looking for, or ways that I should be approaching interviews and information that makes this even easier to archive? Or is that not on me? Is it on me to just do the work that I do and then turn it over to Jordan or you and let you deal with it?
Well, I do think that this is a form of archive. I don't know if you should be archiving anything.
I think the fact that I think that anything I type into Google is going to explode the system is a clear sign that I should not be archiving.
No, I think that this is interesting because one of the things that is happening in a lot of archives are oral histories. This is not necessarily an oral history, but it's a very similar kind of vein of thinking, because it is very oral and is very historical, but is coming from almost a reflective point of view, where we are looking back on the history of the Chazen and presenting it to others to almost create this like circular moment here. And of course, we'll probably have some voices from that time period in the Chazen as well, if we can find them, if they're not dead. But I think it can be archived, but in this digital age, the podcast itself is archived. So in Spotify, in this, in that, I mean, there are so many podcasts that have died, but you can still find them. I think maybe the only things that would probably be archived in terms of like actually filing, shelving, boxing would probably just be maybe correspondence or other like material, like physical materials that are left over from this, because I can't imagine anybody re-recording these podcasts to put them in a box, because digital archiving is a beast that nobody wants to tackle.
How are you building bridges with this information? How do you then turn this noun into a verb when you're working with it? Like, walk me through sort of that process.
Okay.
Because we have a conversation of what the archive is. Mm-hmm. And how things enter an archive. We have an example of that. But I don't have a bridge from taking it from the archive into putting into practice.
Okay. Well, there are two things I can think of off the top of my head. And one is sort of an exhibition, which I guess this could also be kind of class as an exhibition as well, but it's a showcase, really. This is what's in the archive. I'm showing it to you. I've done like photo displays and stuff like that from archival materials that, you know, nobody's really thinking about. So you just make a reproduction of the photo because you don't want to use the original photo, preservation and all of that, and display them, show them. I did one once during homecoming. So it was like old football rivalry stuff, cool photos, an ancient football ticket, that sort of thing. And another one is, which is something that I think we're probably going to do with this, is to take what we find in the archive and do it. Like, here's this 20th century recipe for banana fruit fried salad. I don't know.
Does not sound delicious, but hey.
I mean, it was the 20th century. A lot of those sound kind of sketchy, but to take that and do it and record it and talk about it. So it's another way of both experiencing what's in the archive, but also sharing it with others. Nobody's going to eat that, but it's an experiential thing. I think it's really interesting to take something that is left over on paper, on tape, whatever, and make it physical, make it attainable without having to learn what a finding aid is and how to use one.
So there is some delight. There is some fun. I think that from somebody who comes from a journalist background, and I quickly learned that I am in my own way an archivist, which is kind of crazy. But anyway, it's that I'm finding the delight in learning about it, but then understanding it that I can approach it from my own particular point of view. There is no one way other than finding the information, but I can use any number of terms to find the information. Once I've found the information, I'm not necessarily bound by any particular way of presenting it. It can be through my own personal lens and experiences.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the interesting things about an archive. There's a lot of discourse now about, you know, who owns the archive or who put what into the archive. But to me, at its heart, an archive is like a thesaurus, an encyclopedia, a dictionary, like I said earlier. I'm giving you this item for you to then learn or find whatever word you need and take that and do whatever it is that you need to do with it. But also, it's a way to connect to history in such a tangible manner. I mean, when you find, I'm going back to these recipes because my mind was so blown when I found them. When you find recipes from a 1920-something ball canning book, and I've always wanted to try canning, so I'm sitting there, like, marking page numbers so I can go and copy the recipes out of this book for different fruit preservatives that I'm going to try when I finally have space to can things. So it's just it's a historical moment in your present life.
Meet Me at the Chazen is a production of the Chazen Museum of Art on the campus of UW-Madison in Madison, Wisconsin. Lindsay Grinstead is the Chief of Staff, an omnipotent being. Jordan Craig is a Digital Asset Coordinator, Multimedia Archivist, and Self-Proclaimed Nerd. Rachel Johnson is a graduate student studying Art History and Library Science, UW Archives Processing Assistant, which makes sense because she's nosy. And she's also the project manager for this season. For more information about the museum, its collections and exhibitions, visit chazen.wisc.edu. I'm your host, Busybody and Tattletale, Jennifer Fields. Thanks for listening. Take off her mask, drop to her knees.